I had a question about the Supply Creek project, and you can answer this. Most of my stuff isn't really questions, so maybe answer this when I'm finished, but what exactly is the Supply Creek project? Is maybe you could talk about that just a little more. And then I kind of wanted to touch on the Kamau Medical Center presentation and just say that food is medicine. We need to invest in prevention, like Glenna and Norma and others mentioned. And our fish is a vital component of our diets. And we've invested in our fish, but we need to also invest not so much in treating symptoms, but treating, but providing prevention and wellness and really supporting that. Instead of having all of this sickness and addiction rhetoric, words are powerful. Let's start talking about health and wellness. Let's start talking about being healthy. Let's put that in our school classrooms as opposed to inundating our kids with sickness, negative addiction rhetoric. I see our food system being fragile. We've seen that in COVID, and I don't think we've done a whole lot to improve it since then. All of our food comes in on trucks, probably from the Central Valley where our water is diverted to. We need to be less reliant on those trucks. Our transportation system is fragile, not only in the United States, but especially California. And then not just because of the rugged roads that we live on, that's a part of it, but really this, if there's a food crisis in California, we're gonna be last on the delivery list. We need to really focus on strengthening our food system. We can improve the health of our people. With climate change coming, I doubt there's gonna be any, I think most of our national climate policies will just be reversed come January. So we can lose up to 20% of our farmland by 2030 if we're not paying attention to the challenges that the climate presents. So we can fix that by building our food system here now, strengthening our local food system. We don't have to rely on those trucks. We don't have to rely on a fragile fuel economy or a carbon economy. We can rely on our own people, on our own lands, our own fish, but we have to take the steps to integrate, to prioritize our food system in our policies that we create as a tribe now. So I see that happening with the ag plan and the land use plan. I'd like to see some of that in our climate plan. I know our planning department's working on some of those things. So I just wanted to say all of that.
Thank you, Allie.
Thank you, Allie.
Boy, there's a lot of the say. First is something I learned from probably Danny. There's always have backup plans there. So underneath this sharing thing, I'll start there on that one, because it is the separation and ability to manage Trinity separately will lead to the ability. One of the things that happens in some other areas where there's multiple tribes is river by river or run by run management. And that thing I just mentioned, the separation of Trinity and the Pacific Council, the fact that the Trinity Restoration Program is paying attention to it, funding the studies and information that will go into that. I just testified yesterday at the Pacific Council, and they're going to move forward with that as one of the alternatives post-dam removal. But what it gets at is the ability to, they're harvested in mixed stock fisheries in the ocean, so we can't control that, but you have coated wire tags from the hatchery to tell what, that's the only way they have it, to tell what system it might have came from. When it comes to the mouth of the river, that's the point you're making there, is they have the ability either to target, if there's a reduction in Klamath for some period of time with the dam removal, where are they going to catch the fish? They could well increase their harvest on that. And so river by river, run by run, fall chinook, is we're headed in that direction. The spring run mainly come from this river. that are harvested below us. Same thing there. They're petitioned for listing. But in regards to your first question there, he said a lot. The last 2 years, because of what they've done in ocean fisheries, they've closed them, largely closed those. And despite what the state might say, because to put more fish on the spawning grounds in the Klamath, but it created an awkward situation where we didn't know what the numbers were for the tribal side because, I'll use examples, I'm sorry. In March, if they would have followed their rules, because it's half and half, 50-50, there was 8,000 fish for harvest. They reduced it further by the April meeting on the final salmon season that was set in the ocean, it was 6,300. So that went down by 1,700 because they closed their fisheries. They also closed the river fisheries. And so what did we do? We said, well, your rule says 8,000. So we that number that was spoken to on our graph, we targeted that higher number. But because of all that uncertainty on all the other fisheries, the last 2 years, it hasn't been 80-20. It's been way. 2 years ago, when Yurok said they were going to close their fisheries entirely, they reported 400 fish. We took 1,900, I believe. So that's... We took the brunt of 2 years ago, the fall Chinook, because of the way that the fisheries were managed. And this past year, they targeted a lower number of 5,100. So the numbers would be 5,100 plus our 2,200 that we set, whatever that number is. So just because of the oddity of what the state's doing, largely in the Pacific Council, it's been different. Oh boy, what else? So Supply Creek. You did say that was a direct question. So both the start of that upriver, up the Supply Creek, has all been to increase the diversity. Sometimes it's specific to coho salmon, which are listed, the habitat we're trying to produce. But one of the major sort of philosophies that are there is the lower reaches of the Supply Creek were majorly changed after the 64 flood, and they're pretty much streamlined. And so those projects add complexity. We started that project, as folks, is well known, and Mr. Norton's over there, he's a part of that too. We started work on that the first year. We ran into asbestos over there because there was probably coming from the school there, so we shut the project down until the project got cleaned up. It got a clean bill of health this past year, so we started construction again. But there's also a sanitation facility that PUD needs to recontour and come up with a new system on the other side near Pookie's Park. And so because of that limitation, we stopped construction this year. We did as much as we could. PUD is going to, and we're assisting with that with some of the funding to get that mitigated and removed when it's finally removed, and then we'll complete that project. So that's the Supply Creek one. And I'm not sure what else. All the weird stuff, I believe it's not fully recognized as a management tool because it is non-lethal. That's what I wanted to add. We only catch like a couple of hundred. The net's fishery catches maybe 150, 200 steelhead. With the weir there, it can target the steelhead, and it's a species that should be allocated. So that's it. It has that flexibility to do that. It's one of the things we found, which I think is positive.
Mike and I are probably the oldest people and still around dealing with these issues, Klamath and Trinity, and I hear you on the PR on the dam removal. But there's two reasons for people to go to meetings, right? One is the PR value, right? The other is having the heart to be there, the reason to be there. The pure simple fact today is dams have been removed, but there's no plan. And if you look at the old data, it shows that the fish that used to go up above the upper Klamath area were spring Chinook, not fall Chinook. And so now we got dam removal, we have virtually no spring Chinook left, and people are celebrating fall Chinook getting up to Keno. Keno is the bottom end of the poison pit, of the Klamath River. There is no, we don't believe there's a way to get salmon above Lake Juana at Keno Dam, because if they do get there, it's poison water. And we go to these Klamath meetings, everybody's patting their back, themselves on the back and saying, look what we did, we removed dams. And but the same irrigators are saying, but we want all the water that we can get. And don't control our environmental problems we're causing by the fertilizers. I remember the deal, the Klamath deal, has already eliminated the Iron Gate hatchery, right? Has 15,000 adult salmon that got wiped out. It goes over to Fall Creek hatchery. Fall Creek hatchery will produce half the salmon of the Iron Gate hatchery for 8 years. Then the plan is to wipe out the Fall Creek hatchery. So I go to meetings and I consistently ask, tell me where there's a plan in the world where fish can come back from extinction, let alone in Endangered Species Act listing, in 8 years. That's two brood cycles. And everybody sits there, including the irrigators, saying, not possible. So, yeah, we're celebrating dam removal, and we should. We should get all these things out, but we've got to finish the work before we leave the table. Because if we don't, one of the things that Mike talks about, river by river, run by run, we kind of think that the Trinity River is in jeopardy here. Because if, in fact, Yurok continues to catch 80%, and the fall and the Klamath side goes down, they're going to catch more Trinity, which means we're going to lose our river. And our river is a very important part of the Central Valley diversions and our trust responsibility to make sure we keep our water. We've yet to see what's going to happen on the Klamath River. And I wish that we don't know what Yurok is doing, quite honestly, because they are a fishing tribe that seems to have taken money to not fish. And that's not a good thing. Not for Indian rights, it's not a good, maybe it's a good thing for us because we can cash a check, right? That's not a good thing to keep past, present, and future on our agenda. We're Indian people. We can't trade ourselves for some kind of a deal that whether Congressman Huffman or whoever wants to give them money for not fishing, that's not a deal for HOOPA. So I absolutely understand what you're saying. We'll watch what happens when that hatchery elimination happens in 8 years, when fish are not there and everybody walks away. Remember the deal, one of the deals with the Klamath River, who signed the deal to eliminate the Iron Gate hatchery is Secretary Jewell and Secretary Holland. In that deal, it transfers the federal trust responsibility to the state of California. There's nothing there. There's nothing left after 8 years on federal oversight. We really better watch this. And again, I thank Mike for what he's doing, river by river, run by run. We need to have protections from the Trinity, so when that Klamath system, which we think is going to fail, it's going to be failing in 8 years, we better make sure we can get Trinity fish up through, because if we don't do that, HOOPA's fishing rights are going to go down, and there's no way to replace them. If we try hard to make sure the weir does not eliminate those family fishing sites, because fishing is a tribal member right. Moss or no fish is not an option for them. The weir is helpful to the membership to distribute fish, but we can't lose those fishing rights. And when it gets to a point where whatever happens down the road in 8 years, people blindly say, you know, dam removal happened, but the fishery goes down. That's something that we really are watching hard. There's no plan out there, not even by the state of California. Oregon has a plan that starts at the Oregon line at Hornbrook. And the Klamath River is not even part of their plan because it's in California. California doesn't have a plan. Watch this. We like dam removal for sure. As tribes, we agree that rivers should not be dammed, but don't overlook our responsibility to make sure that those fish can survive. And if they cannot survive, one of the things that Mike's program is doing also is the Trinity River Hatchery. Because if the Trinity River Hatchery, depending on what happens with the Trump administration, they start taking water, we better make sure the hatchery does good. The Fisheries Department hatchery it puts fish back in our streams. But that Trinity River Hatchery is what we rely on when everything fails. So anyway, I like dam removal, but I'm not sure that it's worth celebrating yet until we see what the rest of the plan looks like.
Thanks, Danny. Did you have something, Pam? Come on up.
Comment on the Supply Creek restoration. On the north side there's a whole little group of Tree of Heavens coming up, and I was just wanted to let somebody know, because before they get, those things grow fast and they're thick, and you got to pull them out by their roots. So I've been watching them. They're getting big fast, so before it starts, I'd just like someone to notice that. I notice it everywhere, but once you see a few of them coming, then they're going to just take over. So I just wanted someone to know. It's kind of right by their project, by Lyle Marshall's there. So I don't know.
Where? Kenny? Oh, go ahead, Ellie. Thanks, Ben.
Sorry, I forgot a couple of things, but yeah, the Tree of Heaven / Hell is taking over Hoopa. We need to have an invasive species component in our new FMP. Hopefully we can really hit that hard. Anyway, Sites Reservoir, speaking of dam removal, Sites Reservoir in Colusa, we're pro-dam removal for obvious reasons, right? We saw what it did to our fishery, to our people, to our health, and our neighbors all around throughout the nation, throughout California, and right here at home. Are we, as a tribe, opposing Sites Reservoir? I know they haven't had public hearings in Northern California. I'm a little nervous that they're building another piece of giant water infrastructure, although they're saying it won't affect us, or it won't, no additional water will be taken from the Trinity River. How do we trust that promise into the future, especially with changing administrations and changing water policy, and obviously reclamation's complete disregard for already agreed upon water rights, right? So they're building a new piece of giant water infrastructure in California that will be fed by some Trinity River water. What are we doing to stop that? What are we doing to advocate for public hearings in Northern California? As far as I know, there's only been public hearings in Sacramento. They haven't come north to offer the opportunity for folks who can't travel to Sacramento to speak up. So Sites Reservoir, we need to be on that. There was one other thing, and I forgot what it was. I'll remember later, but that was it.
Yeah, go ahead, Danny.
I don't mean to do this all day long, but anyway, Sites Reservoir. Sites Reservoir doesn't, it's a dam that's being proposed as a container dam in California. Doesn't have a designated water stream to it, other than its diverting Sacramento water during winter months. There's a lot of concern about river systems are supposed to be river systems, and they're not supposed to be diverted and contained and held, kind of like you put your water barrel outside and hold your winter water, right? These are river systems. And Ali's exactly right. We don't know what the effect of this is going to be. When we as people remove that much water from the Sacramento River during the wintertime and hold it for distributing during the summertime, that's greed. I mean, that's nothing more than greed. And it's another example that California doesn't have a water plan. And we're just in a secondary part of that is elevating the Shasta Dam. Now, the elevating the Shasta Dam is supposed to back water up into the Pitt River country. And Pitt River people, you know, and these river systems themselves, Native people have had homes, villages in the bottom of the rivers, right? But down by the river system. So what's below Shasta Dam is Indian villages, right? So we're back it into Pitt River country now. It's an example that California is out of control. You know, they've already got contracts for 10 times the water supply that's available. We need to understand as a tribe, that's who they are. So we better make sure that, one, we don't lose connection to this water. If we lose connection to the water, we become just simply one more movable object. And we need to be like the weir. We need to be hard to move off of our land, off of our water. But I agree. Hoopa, to my knowledge, does not have a position on site's reservoir. But California is running out of water, and so where does the water come from for this California greed? I mean, they're not stopping growth in California. They're expanding growth.
I had a couple things to add, too, sort of along the lines of the threats in the future. So Sites Reservoir originally was a federal project, I believe. Now it's a state project. What I would say with what's coming immediately down the pike is this administration just completed their long-term operations plan. There'll be a biological opinion for all the listed species in the Sacramento River. That was today, Friday, and then the biological opinions will be coming down. And that's a direct reflection of the state of California versus the Interior Department, Trump administration biological opinions. So there's a big fight brewing there between the federal and state government. But the other factor I believe is really important is there's a whole bunch of legislation. There's a shift in the House, Senate, and in the past we had the president could have vetoed something, but there was this past session, it was called H.R. 215, just eliminates all the laws and the restoration programs in the Central Valley, including the Trinity River Restoration Program. So that's also going to be a mounting, probably both of those things, really immediate concerns before Sites gets online, I believe.
Thanks, Mike. Danny. Anybody else? Anybody have their hands raised on the Zoom? No? Anybody else? Questions? Yeah, come on up.
How's it going, Council? Mike? Jason Jackson, roll number 5183. I just wanted to express my feelings on the Fisheries Department when it comes to the youth. I didn't see any youth programs being established this summer or really ever. I was part of a Hutt and Junior Fisheries program scholar, and during high school, that was a great program. It really influenced me to go towards fisheries as a profession. I graduated from Humboldt State in 2019 with my fisheries biology degree with an emphasis in freshwater. So I could come back here to my homeland and, have that assurance of a job as well as, serve, my inherent responsibility to, conserve our natural resources and, you know, our fish is mainly. So I'd like to see just more youth programs in that department there. I know they have that program where they pay for like the schooling or something, or keep them employed while they go to school. That's a great program, but there's no recruitment, you know, for the youth, you know, the kids, you know, that K through 8 or even high school, which is our future. If we're going to be talking about our future and our membership, we need to, you know, really target those guys. And also, I just want to just express my opinion towards hatcheries. I don't agree with hatcheries at all. I feel like it's a short-term solution with long-term consequences. And Mike, I'm sure you know the consequences of hatcheries, you know, genetic loss and viability and, you know, susceptible to diseases. It reminds me of Pratt, the guy that he was the founder of the Carlisle Indian Boarding School, and he said, kill the Indian, save the man, you know, and that was to assimilate, you know, to the Native Americans and, you know, some of your parents, some of my grandparents, you know, that's what these hatcheries bring to me. You know, it's like, oh, kill the wild salmon, but save the salmon. You know, those wild salmon, those are like natives, you know, those are native species. And so by having these hatcheries, those are farm fish, you know, you're going to grow farm fish, you're going to feed them wild fish, you're going to take wild fish from out in the ocean to feed these farm fish. It's not sustainable. It doesn't make sense at all. So I really am opposed to the hatcheries. I don't think it's sustainable for our future. We need to be doing more restoration or, you know, more best practices, approaches to, you know, save our population. I just want to, I guess, just say that. More youth programs. It'd be great to see some kids out there. I know they love it. You see the salmon run, you know, you see the kids, they're having a good time. They're out there running for their salmon. I think they'd be stoked if they could get paid to work in the creeks and the rivers over the summertime. So, and then hatcheries, I don't know. I just think it's not the way to go. And that's all there is to it. We need to find a better approach to manage that resource. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Jason.
Run?
Sure.
Okay. As far as the education thing, that has been always a strong component of our program. It is, and one of the goals and objectives is to promote education, and we've done that across the years during my tenure as the director of the program. We've had salmon camp, we've had interns, we've funded tribal members to go to school. We're presently funding one today. We have also, the personnel policies have a section in there, there's some discretion there. We've developed a program where you can recruit tribal wide or we can be promoted. Somebody wants to go to school within the program, that's presently one of the students that we are funding. So we have been strong proponents of education and or promoting tribal members into professional positions. We've also worked with the school a lot over the years that's where most of our technicians come from. And so I think that's a strong component of our program. As far as hatcheries go, that's a long debated thing if you go to school. I've been to Humboldt State University, like a lot of people. There's a lot of abstract things about genetics and those types of things. One of the things that has emerged is there's a conservation hatchery. For example, our hatchery, on the lower Trinity River, they do surveys and they find there's a theoretic number that needs to be restored for recovering endangered species. But there's very little production. If you look at our weirs and the Willow Creek weir and the Hoopoe weir, there's very little evidence. They mark all of the hatchery coho, so 95 to 98% of them are marked coho. Excuse me, unmarked. Oh, wait, the other way around. So, very little evidence of natural production, and so That's why our hatchery here, we revamped that a couple of years ago. We got about, there was $2 million this past year of tribal hatchery monies that the Lummi tribe of Northwest tribe that we worked a lot with over the years. Anyway, they secured money. We have $2 million for revitalization of our hatchery. We got $700,000 of O&M money from BIA under the some of the Biden administration initiative funding. And so, but it's a conservation hatchery. We release fish for 2 years now in the upper Mill Creek. And so there's an idea there that there might not be any coho left. So to the degree you can produce a naturally, genetically, and what are those other words, adaptability type population to explore what the productivity is in those basins or another approach. We've also worked with, we talked with some of the things where we have conflict with our neighboring tribes. We have worked with Yurok on kind of promoting that idea in the Upper Trinity. They're taking a different approach. They release fish up near Grass Valley Creek. There's a dam up there where they're just putting the eggs in the incubators and having them imprint on the water supply. And so they're trying to jumpstart populations. That's a different approach. And I think that's something that really what I've said is rather than kind of expanding their operation in the Trinity, that whole Klamath situation is really they're going to wait. They call it volitional. They're going to wait and see what the natural production produces. I think there's a large opportunity to do some things that are going to recolonize and reestablish natural populations of fish. Natural is another terminology thing here. Anything that spawns outside the hatchery is a natural fish. It's not genetically pure, any of them that you look at. So anyway, that's a long debate. If you go to school, and I don't know, I've been a part of some of those over my career, but some of it's pretty abstract in my opinion, but that's the purpose. There's kind of specific purpose. For the other thing at Trinity River Hatchery is it's a mitigation hatchery. The lost production above the dam is to mitigate for all the fish that were above there. And so that's a specific mitigation function, which is different than a conservation hatchery. But thanks for your question.
Is there anybody else? Okay, thanks, Mike. We're going to move on to the last presentation. Do you know if Keith's up there available? If not, we can wait a few minutes and maybe take a short break. Come back when Keith is available, if he is.
Chairman, yes, I am available.
You're available? Okay.
I can dive in if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Next up is the presentation by Keith Anderson for AIM Law on Cannabis Regulations.
Say something during the open session?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, before you do, Danny would like to make a few comments.
Absolutely.
Kenny Norton stayed around for a compliment. I just want to say that there was a lot of pictures that were taken about the TEPA cars in the CalPAC. One, thank you for doing that. Not the trash stuff. That's a consequence of this process. You don't have the staff to monitor it, but Kenny's program and TEPA collected over 200 cars from the reservation. That's great. The consequence of that, because we don't have the staff to manage it and to control what comes in, people take advantage of it and bring trash in. If you go look at CalPAC today, Kenny's crew has cleaned it all up and has done an amazing job. So other than that brief picture photo thing about the problems up there, you did a good job.
Thanks, Ken. Thank you, Ken. Okay, I think go ahead, come on up, Glenna. Before you get going, Keith, got another comment.
Sorry, this will be quick. Along with that, and you know, a few of the other presentations about our youth, we really need to work with our youth in connecting them to our land. It's really sad to go up into the woods and see dumped TVs, wash machines, mattresses. People are going up and just dumping their garbage up in our woods. And I know that we don't have the resources in terms of personnel to go up and clean everything, but even if we had work parties or something where we could get ourselves together and start, you know, working on that. I believe Kenny's program had a grant that did some of that work a couple of years ago. But I'll go up, and a week later, I'll see a dryer or something that somebody had just dumped. So it didn't happen like 5 or 10 years ago. It's happening all the time. And I know, you know, it'd be nice to see some youth programs that we really got them out there and really getting them out into the woods, whether it's through a trail system or you know, science projects or whatever, but really reconnecting with our land. They are our future stewards, and we have to really get them to understand the value, you know, compared to other tribes. Our tribe looks like a postage stamp in terms of the acreages in California are looking at Navajo, but we've got a beautiful reservation here. We've got beautiful land, but we've got to really start taking care of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Okay, Heath, I think the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Chairman. I have a presentation I'd like to bring up and see if this works. All right, perfect. You guys can all see the presentation, correct? Great. Okay. Well, good evening, and thank you, everyone, for inviting me to speak with you tonight. My name is Keith Anderson, and before diving into the heart of my presentation, I'd like to take just a minute or two to discuss a little bit about who I am, just so you can get to know me a little bit. I'm originally from the Narragansett Indian Tribe, which is located in modern-day Rhode Island, and currently living in Mill Valley, California. I'm a founding partner of AIM Law. It's a law firm which is dedicated to advancing economic development in Indian country. We do a lot of things, from gaming and hospitality to convenience stores and fuel stations. We do a fair amount of online lending. I personally do a lot of finance work. I work on behalf of both lenders, tribal lenders owned by, like banks owned by Indian tribes, as well as a number of tribal borrowers. But the reason I'm here tonight is to speak about tribal cannabis, which I've had the great pleasure of working in since 2015. I myself created the tribal cannabis business, legal, and regulatory infrastructures for Santa Isabel, for Moortown Rancheria, for Chichansey, Enterprise Rancheria, Prairie Island, and a number of other tribes. I'm a former Cannabis Commission Chair. I was the Cannabis Commission Chair for Chichansey for a little over 2 years. I'm a current EDC board member for cannabis operations over at Moortown Rancheria, and a lecturer in tribal cannabis at Oaksterdam University. I mentioned that last point because the presentation that I'm going to go through, some of the slides are adopted from my lectures at Oaksterdam University. And the reason that I pulled some of those slides for tonight is because I think that having an understanding for how tribal cannabis came to be, particularly tribal cannabis as a tribal cannabis industry, both the how it was created, the when it was created, and the what it is valuable from the perspective that it gives context to why tribal cannabis tends to work in the same way. And what I mean by that is that there is, at this point, a fairly well-worn path for how to regulate cannabis in Indian country and to do so the right way. And I think if you have some background and some context as to how it came to be, there's the logic to tribal cannabis becomes more evident. I'm going to start with the United States as a whole and the current status of cannabis in the United States today. It's radically different than it was 15 or 20 years ago. This slide that you're looking at, all of the green, those are areas where cannabis is legal in some form. The very dark green, the green that almost looks black, those are areas, and specifically states, where cannabis is legal, both medicinal and adult use. The lighter green states are states where cannabis is either legal in a medicinal form or is at least decriminalized. And so what you're seeing is that in 3/4 of the United States, cannabis is legal in some form. In those sort of gray colored states, those are states where cannabis is legal from the perspective of you can have CBD with THC mixed within it. But what this map is also showing is that there's actually today only 4 states in the entire United States where cannabis is just flat out illegal. Indian country has followed a similar trajectory. These red dots that you're seeing on the screen, those are tribal dispensaries in operation today. You'll notice that there are high concentrations in states like Washington and Nevada, but there's also some fairly high concentrations in states like New York, Michigan, Minnesota, and California. In fact, there has been a 30% increase in the number of tribal dispensaries just since 2023. So today you're looking at least 57 tribally owned dispensaries owned by approximately 47 tribes. In fact, there's a pretty common graph. You could pull this off of Google. And when I wanted to grab it for this presentation, I realized that despite the fact that this was created in 2023, it was really outdated. The bars that you're looking at, those are in the original graph, but I went ahead and put in those arrows that you're seeing on this graph because just in an 18-month to 2-year period, in states like California and Minnesota, 2 states I work in quite a bit, the number of tribal dispensaries has roughly doubled. And that's just kind of showing the growth of tribal cannabis as an industry in a pretty short period of time. As I mentioned at the onset, I think there's a lot of value in understanding what tribal cannabis really is. And to answer that question, I think we have to know the when and how did it start. To describe that, I want to go back quite a bit, more than 100 years ago, back to 1915. Because despite the fact that California is considered by many to be kind of like the mecca of cannabis, at least in the United States, California was actually the first state to make it illegal to possess cannabis way back in 1915. Now, in 1915, that didn't have much of an effect on Indian country. California did not have jurisdiction over Indian country in 1915. But that changed in 1953. In 1953, the United States Congress adopted PL 280, which handed criminal jurisdiction and certain civil jurisdiction over Indian country to the state of California. Thus, as of 1953, the state of California had the right to criminally prosecute persons possessing cannabis in Indian country. That's something it hadn't had before 1953. And that's fairly recently, you know, throughout the history of California and Indians in California, it's only in the last half century or so that California has had direct jurisdictional rights over Indian country. In 1988, though, the Supreme Court clarified, in a very important decision, a lot of you probably heard of this before, in the Cabazon case, that PL 280, the federal law that did give California certain jurisdiction over Indian tribes, didn't actually hand over civil regulatory jurisdiction over Indian country to the state of California. And that's important because in 1996, California voted in favor of Proposition 215, which legalized medical cannabis in the state of California. And a couple of years later, in 2003, California adopted SB 420, which regulated medical cannabis. Now, under PL 280, as interpreted by Cabazon, once a state regulates an activity, it no longer has the ability to regulate that activity in Indian country. meaning a state like California, once 2003 came around, no longer had jurisdiction over tribally regulated medical cannabis in Indian country. And debatably, and I do take this position, it also did not have jurisdiction over tribally regulated recreational cannabis in Indian country as of 2003. But that kind of begs a question, right? If California no longer had jurisdiction over tribally regulated cannabis starting in 2003, then why did tribally regulated cannabis not exist until 2015? To answer that question, we need to look at federal law. In 1971, cannabis was officially outlawed on the federal level for any use, medicinal or otherwise, with the passage of the CSA, the Controlled Substances Act. Thus, even though the state of California was largely prohibited from lawfully enforcing its cannabis laws in Indian country starting in 2003, the federal government very much could still enforce federal cannabis laws in Indian country. In other words, Indian country was largely protected from state enforcement, but not federal enforcement. But that too changed. In 2013, the Department of Justice issued something called the Cole Memorandum. And this memorandum instructed U.S. attorneys not to interfere with cannabis activities operating under state-sanctioned regulatory and enforcement systems, provided those systems effectively addressed eight specific federal priorities. Now, this memorandum was released in 2013 because if you can go back 10 years in time, many of you probably remember this, a lot of states, California included, had started to legalize cannabis in some forms. This put DOJ in kind of a strange position because technically cannabis was still federally illegal. So to resolve this kind of strange dichotomy, the Department of Justice issued this memorandum that basically said, states, as long as you are able to demonstrate to us, the federal government, that you know how to regulate this stuff and you can meaningfully mitigate the dangers, the harms, and other priorities that we have at the federal government side of things, then we're going to stay hands off. A couple of tribes, though, wrote to the DOJ and said, well, what about us? And DOJ responded in 2014, and they responded in something called the Wilkinson Memorandum. And what the Wilkinson Memorandum does is it extends the exact same prosecutorial guidelines of the Cole Memorandum to Indian country. Thus, under both of these memoranda, the Cole Memorandum and the Wilkinson Memorandum, Indian tribes and states are treated exactly the same under federal law. And I want to emphasize that because I know that there's a lot of people who believe that the states have some sort of special privilege or there's some special laws that are applicable to them when it comes to cannabis. And from the federal perspective, the answer is no. The federal government treats tribes and states exactly the same when it comes to cannabis regulation. So then in 2015, and I had just had the great privilege of working with an amazing group of people in 2015, started honestly end of 2014, the Ipe Nation of Santa Isabel began cultivating tribally regulated medical cannabis, free from state interference because of Cabazon, and free from federal interference because the tribe allowed followed to a T the guidance set forth in the Wilkinson Memorandum. In 2018, California legalized recreational cannabis. That was from a voter initiative that was actually voted on in 2016, but it did not take effect until 2018. And they also adopted SB 94, which is California legislation which uniformly regulates both recreational as well as medicinal cannabis. Thus, this kind of question as to whether or not the state could still enforce certain rules against Indian country, i.e., were tribes excluded to only engaging in medicinal cannabis, that question was eliminated because as of 2018, the state of California regulates both recreational and medicinal cannabis for its residents. And under Cabazon, that means that tribes are able to regulate recreational and medicinal cannabis pursuant to tribal law. So if you were to ask me, like, when did tribal cannabis truly begin, you know, as like a regulated activity, I'll tell you that that started in 2015. And that started when Santa Isabel and its tribal government developed an ordinance, created a cannabis commission, and allowed that commission to promulgate regulations that meaningfully met the requirements that are set forth in both the Cole and the Wilkinson memoranda. Establishing a structure, because at Santa Isabel they have many, many operations, by which both government and private-owned cannabis businesses could lawfully operate within its borders. Based on that, Santa Isabel created cultivation, manufacturing, retail, distribution. They even had a lab on the reservation at one point. And since that time in 2015, you know, because then I would have called it tribal cannabis. I would not have called it an industry. But since then, tribal cannabis has grown into an industry because there's now approximately 50 tribes across the country engaged in some form of tribally regulated commercial cannabis. So how does HOOPA potentially fit within this emerging industry? Well, I personally find HOOPA to be uniquely positioned for two reasons. Number one is its geographic location. You are located in the quote-unquote Green Triangle, and you have what is the equivalent of what Napa wine is to the alcohol and wine industry. Green Triangle, Humboldt cannabis, that has that same reputation. You also have an extraordinary number of tribal members who are experienced craft cultivators. And those two things combined allow HOOPA to be meaningful participants in this emerging cannabis industry, because quality sun-grown cannabis is in high demand in California, as well as other states. Now, if you look on the left-hand side of this slide, you'll see those same red dots from my much larger map. Those still represent dispensaries in Indian country. And you'll also notice a bunch of arrows, some blue, some kind of a pinkish purple color. And those represent the two dominant distributors in Indian country, Santa Isabel and DVJ, now at Death Valley. You'll also notice that they're both located in the south, and you'll also notice that they are all shipping their products north. There really isn't a top shelf distributor of flower products, whatever it is, coming from the north and shipping their products south. Now, DVJ and Santa Isabel create great product. They have great indoor product. But there is not anybody in Indian country right now that I truly believe is producing high quality sun-grown outdoor cannabis the way that HOOPA is. And so when you ask me, how does HOOPA potentially fit within this emerging industry? It's because you have something that's in high demand and nobody else is really doing at the same level that I think many of your members are. So how can HOOPA, as a government, support a sovereign economy and create intertribal commerce? Well, HOOPA's tribal government can provide its people with the same tools and infrastructure that other sovereign governments have provided their people to enable tribal entrepreneurs to prosper in the cannabis space. Like other states and tribes that have been successful in the cannabis space, it can create a governing structure that meaningfully addresses federal guidance set forth in the Cole and Wilkinson memorandum. Because in the absence of that structure, HOOPA tribal growers will remain at heightened risk of federal prosecution and will remain limited in their ability to participate in intertribal commerce. And I'll focus on that last point for just a minute. As this industry becomes more and more professional, and is continuing to operate on a very high level, the major purchasers in Indian country, stores like Moortown that do like $500,000 a month, stores like Chachansi, that also do very high volumes, they are requiring professionalism, they are requiring certain licensing standards, testing standards, manifest standards, in order to even purchase from other tribal distributors. And the reason is because they're operating on the same level as the states, and they're following the exact same guidance, specifically federal guidance, as the states. The Cole and the Wilkinson memorandum. I do mean this. Require that a tribal government that authorized marijuana-related conduct, that implements strong and effective regulatory and enforcement systems that will address the 8 federal priorities. This is why every tribe, and I do mean every tribe, that has successfully entered the cannabis space, they all have an ordinance, they all have regulations, they all have regulatory oversight. And all of these three things collectively address those 8 federal priorities I've been mentioning. Now, I have mentioned these 8 federal priorities 5, 6, maybe even 7 times, but I haven't told you what they are yet. And these are it. Like I said, every tribe that has successfully entered the regulated tribal cannabis industry has drafted ordinances, drafted regulations, and has commissioners, or some form of a tribal regulatory body that addresses these federal priorities. Number one is the prevention of the distribution of marijuana to minors. In tribes that have entered the cannabis space on a regulated industrial level, they establish and enforce restrictions on advertising to minors, including restrictions on packaging and advertising, and have rules in place for sanctions for sales to minors. The regulations will have provisions directed specifically at the prevention of marijuana revenue going to criminal enterprises. And the way that tribes generally do this is by establishing and enforcing licensing standards, not dissimilar from what's at the casino, not dissimilar from the standards that are used by the state. And it requires that every person from source to sale is backgrounded and vetted by a tribal regulatory agency. Now, I'll pause here just to make clear that this does not necessarily mean that anybody who's ever been convicted of a felony cannot work in the cannabis industry. Most states and many tribes do have felony forgiveness programs. Sometimes they're called social equity programs. But also, to be very honest, this sometimes can exclude people who have very severe felonies, particularly if they've been very recent. But that's not to say that any felony prohibits people from working in the cannabis industry. It doesn't. Federal priority number 3. Prevention of diversion of marijuana to other states where it is illegal. This is another priority of the Department of Justice. And tribes, to address this federal priority, they will always establish some sort of standardized inventory control system. Many of you have probably heard the term metric before, but metric is just one inventory control system. Tribes use a variety of methods, and smaller operations oftentimes use what I would consider nothing more than a sophisticated Excel spreadsheet. So the inventory control systems can be relatively basic and they can be very sophisticated, but what they have to be is something that's transparent, and they also have to be something that allows audits to be conducted by a tribal regulatory agency. You also want to make sure that you have created some sort of standardized delivery protocols, including transportation manifests. And the details on all of this should be spelled out in a fair level of detail in the regulations that a tribal cannabis, say a tribal cannabis directed government puts in place. Fourth is prevention of marijuana as a pretext for other illegal activity. And the way that this is typically addressed, and this is much, much more of a concern for larger operations, but when you do have a larger operation, you want to set forth minimum security standards. Those standards for small operations do not have to be particularly elaborate. But if you're dealing with, say, like a 15,000 square foot cultivation facility, well, at that point, your security and your surveillance systems are pretty much on par with a casino. You also want to make sure, whether the operation is small or large, that you're establishing regulatory agency rights to conduct investigations and hold hearing on licensing matters, i.e. making sure that marijuana is being used for the purposes it's supposed to be used for. DOJ is concerned with the prevention of violence and firearms in marijuana activity. And establishing and enforcing restrictions on gun possession in cannabis facilities is the most direct way to address that. They also have concerns with the prevention of drugged driving and other public health concerns. Most tribes will include some sort of drugged driving law, perhaps creating a new law or incorporating it into their prohibitions on driving under the influence of alcohol. The other thing that every tribe that I know of that's been doing this in a successful high-level way will establish and enforce comprehensive product labeling, including warning labels, labels that are directed by regulations and require certain information to be provided to consumers. Part of that information comes from laboratory testing standards, which also need to be a part of a robust set of tribal regulations.